of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is the Marvel Monday episode for the week, and we'll be talking about a few of the books that came out last Wednesday, November 7th, from Marvel, as well as continuing our look at Charles Soule's run on Daredevil. So let's start with Immortal Hulk number 8. His Hideous Heart is the name of it. Love the alliteration, and it definitely, you know, it seems like that's would be the story of like an Edgar Allan Poe story or some cool story from like House of Secrets or House of Mystery or old school tales of suspense. It just has an old school horror feel to it. So this issue is written by Al Ewing. We've got pencils by regular series artist Joe Bennett, inks by Rue Jose, colors by Paul Mounts, and letters by VC's Corey Petit. So we saw last issue that it ended on this crazy scene after the Hulk had been captured. They basically cut him up into pieces at the shadow base. That's kind of the new version of the Hulkbusters, I suppose you'd call it, with General 14 in charge. And this issue picks up where that one left off. You know, the Hulk cut up, placed in jars on a shelf. And this issue starts off with them kind of explaining how that happened. And basically, the dissection happened while, or a lot of the dissection happened while Hulk was still Bruce Banner, right? Because once he started to change, with an adamantium scalpel and an hydraulic arm that cost $7 million to make, it could bend titanium like paper, but even so, it whined dangerously as this adamantium blade cut up what organs they needed to still dissect further after they turned green, basically, and grew. So the issue starts off with them cutting the heart in half, and even as they took the heart to a lab to be placed in jars, they're walking along the corridor, and even though this heart is cut in two, it begins to beat. And so the doctor who apparently is in charge of these experiments is actually excited by this, and he wants to understand what's the science here, right? Any ideas? He's in the room with all the jars, including the Hulk's head, and he's talking to him, saying, not you, big guy, I don't mean you, because look at you, you couldn't talk, you have no air in your lungs, you don't even have lungs, and science isn't really your specialty, right? Let's be civil, Hulk, right? Now, someone hand me his heart. I want to play with it for a minute. And the other scientist says, Dr. Clive, don't we need to run more tests? You shouldn't just be handling it. And he says, this is a test. I'm in my moment. Let's see what happens. As he holds the two halves of the heart together, there's a schlurp sound as the heart knits itself back together. And Clive's interested by that. He says, look, it's as good as new. It's dead meat on the table. It's alive again once it gets close to the rest of its body, and it heals, it regenerates. So we've got questions, right? We've got questions. But why not full regeneration, right? Like, why isn't the head of Hulk growing a new body? Why doesn't a new Hulk spring from every organ, like little Hulk seeds? Why this and not that? And she speculates, well, perhaps it's a psionic link, right? Autonomic control over the individual cells. But Dr. Clive's like, no, there's zero psionic activity. And plus, he had his hypothalamus destroyed and he came back from that. So what's the key? What's the science? What are the rules? We have to know the rules. Otherwise, how can we break them? Meanwhile, in space at the Alpha Flight Station, Carol Danvers is talking to her team. She's worried. You know, she was part of the team of Avengers that helped capture the Hulk. But then all of a sudden, they turned him over to the authorities, and then he just disappeared, right? Thaddeus Ross denies all knowledge. General 14 is MIA. He can't be found. And any requests for information are misfiled, or people that might know are all of a sudden fired or reassigned. And Banner appears to just have disappeared. So did the U.S. government lose the Hulk or kidnap him? And we see also on the space station behind her is Jacqueline McGee, the reporter, as well as Walter Lankowski, formerly Sasquatch. And Jackie's saying, I can quote you as an anonymous source. And Carol says, yes, unfortunately, it has to be anonymous because Alpha Flight doesn't have the bandwidth to go to open war with this administration, not on top of everything else. But your story should put pressure on them, and hopefully it'll get them to make a mistake. And maybe if they move him again, we can locate him. And Walter says, yeah, only if he's above ground and his gamma signature hasn't changed. For all we know, he can alter it at will, right? We don't really know what Bruce is capable of when he's cornered or wounded. And if anything that this horror has taught me so far, it's that gamma mutation can never be predicted. And so Carol says, well, you are the expert and your leave of absence is over. I need you back on active duty now. And Walter's like, but I can't even be Sasquatch anymore. Like, what? How can I be part of the team? And Carol's like, look, you're a noted gamma researcher. You've got combat training and you've got insight into Bruce Banner's mind. I don't need Sasquatch. I need you. So I'm going to call a press conference later. And Miss McGee here can have the exclusive, and I've got to resign from our and she goes on to say that her mission is to protect Earth, and in light of this, the U.S. government rumor that they lost the Hulk, I'm creating a new task force. And Jackie's like, and what is this task force going to call itself? And Walter smiles and says, what else? Gamma Flight. And meanwhile, Clive is getting a call from General 14, and they're worried about having overplayed their hand. And obviously, with this new information, they've got to be as careful as possible. And so General 14 has given the order to relocate to the B site. And Charlene's not happy about that. She's like, really? In the middle of all this, it's going to take days. Dr. Clive says, I know, but it's not, we don't have any options, right? It's not what anyone wants at the end of a long night's work, but get ready to transport to Site B while I start prepping Red Dog just as soon as I finish with the jigsaw puzzle here. And as he looks to the Hulk's head, the Hulk is smiling. Clive's like, what's so funny? You know, your superhero friends are making life difficult. And what we've done to you here, it's just the start, because I'll take you apart cell by cell if I have to. We'll cut that smile off. We'll slice you down to the bone. We'll pop your eyes like a water balloon if we have to see if they grow back. We're experimenting on you. What's so funny? As the Hulk's grin grows wider and wider, he's like, we're going to turn you into a weapon. We're going to learn your secrets, your heart, how your heart beats, how your fingers move, all of it. We'll find out exactly what you can do. And as he says that, he realizes, wait, you let us do this. You wanted us to do this. Because if we know what you can do, then you know what you can do. And yeah, the Hulk has been just playing along all this time as one of his hands breaks out of the jar, and then the rest of the body parts soon follow. And not only does the Hulk begin to reform himself, but he captures Dr. Clive inside of him as he begins to reform himself, while Dr. Clive's yelling, I'm sorry, I'm just doing what I was told to do. I was only following orders. As he's reaching for the emergency alarm switch, but he can't quite reach it. And he's whispering that he's sorry. And the Hulk says, not sorry enough. You wanted science? You wanted a set of rules from me? Big mistake, man. Science is the other guy. And when you hurt him, I take it personally. So that's interesting that he still feels a need to protect Bruce Banner. So Charlene then attempts to re-enter the lab. And as she does, there's no sign of Dr. Clive. And there's a giant hole in the floor as the Hulk has escaped. Meanwhile, back on Alpha Flight Station, they're talking about trying to find the Hulk based on his gamma signature. And they've found nothing so far. And they're speculating it could mean he's underground or a shielded facility. And it really is a needle in a haystack, because last time they got lucky. There were reported sightings, and so it gave them a starting point of where to look. But now they don't know where to start looking. It could be anywhere. It could be New York. It could be New Mexico. It could be California. And if he's underground, then maybe they won't see him at all. And Lukowski's like, yeah, I get it, but let me know if you do find anything. And then he turns to Jackie and says, man, this really could take a while unless we can think of another way to find them. And she catches that right away, like, I'm sorry, we? And Lankowski says, yeah, you've been chasing the Hulk across the country for months, so we really could use your help. And Jackie says, yeah, this is Gamma Flight. You're all like superheroes or secret agents. I'm just a reporter. And Lankowski says, so you can be an embedded reporter, right? I know you've still got questions and we really could use your help. So meanwhile, we see the Hulk emerge from underground and he realizes he's in New Mexico. He was basically buried under a mountain in northern New Mexico, which means oddly for him, he's kind of home in a way. He's close to his birthplace. New Mexico was where the testing happened that created the Hulk. But it's daytime as he emerges and as the sun is rising, he turns back into to Bruce Banner. Who has a queasy feeling because he does realize that there's a long-held line that's been crossed. The Hulk has taken a life, and for a moment he thought he heard his father's voice laughing at him from everywhere at once as he puts on the lab coat that the Hulk brought with him and begins walking toward the road. So really interesting story here. There's so much to unpack. Like, how did the Hulk put his own body back together from being chopped up into bits, basically? How was he still sentient with just his head in a jar, right? It's, I don't know that we're ever going to find the answers other than there's almost a supernatural or a metaphysical aspect to the Hulk that Al Ewing is introducing here, right? But very much in the horror vein, right? Like our other episode for Monday's Aftershock Monday, where we're talking about Black Eyed Kids, the horror series from Aftershock. So appropriate that we would talk about Immortal Hulk as well. And fitting that it's called Immortal Hulk because, I mean, the Hulk was literally chopped in pieces, floating in a jar. Many jars actually, and it couldn't kill him. He truly is immortal, and Banner is as well. So love the story and the narrative that Al Ewing is telling. Love the art by Joe Bennett. It really suits the kind of horrific feel because his art is so detailed that it borders on a very visceral experience. So I hope you guys are all picking up Immortal Hulk, and I think everybody is because the sales numbers on it continue to climb. It's probably Marvel's best title right now. So kudos to the entire creative team. It's a really compelling read, and it's been a lot of fun so far. So, you know, great art from Joe Bennett, great inks from Rue Jose, really fleshing out the Hulk and giving some good texture, which is a lot of what helps set the mood, along with the color work from Paul Mounts that's been very vibrant so far. I mean, oftentimes in horror books, there's a tendency to go really dark and use somewhat of a more muted palette. And I love that Mounts has kind of taken it the other way. He's still keeping it bright, which kind of reminds us of the roots of the Hulk title as it's been a superhero title for, you know, decades and decades now, but also doing a great job of setting tone and mood in terms of giving it somewhat of a horror vibe and helping to set the mood and the tone and keep it so compelling. So incredible work by Paul Mounts as well. Really, really fun issue. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is Infinity Wars number 5. This is from writer Jerry Dugan with art by Mike Diodato Jr. and colors by Frank Martin with letters by Corey Petit. And this is continuing the story of Gamora with the Infinity Stones now and her having folded the universe in half. And that's how we got all the warped heroes like Doctor Strange and Captain America mashup. I can't even remember what he's called right now. He's the Soldier Supreme, right? Instead of the Sorcerer Supreme. So in this issue, we see Loki has gathered his team and they go to, they're in, trapped inside the soul gem, because that's basically what Gamora did. Not only did she fold the universe in half, but she took a copy of it and put it inside the soul gem, and it's being devoured by Devoura. And once it's devoured, she will be able to remake the universe as she sees fit with the power of the soul gems. So Loki with his team manages to, locate the Gamora of the soul gem universe, let's call it, because again, that universe is a copy of the real universe. So of course there's a copy of Gamora, and they're able to befriend her. Loki's team is able to befriend her, and Loki passes out the Infinity Stones that this version of Gamora has, and they're able to overcome the Gamora of the actual physical Marvel universe and take the stones from her. But in the midst of doing that, as the battle is winding down, Loki, ever the trickster, manages to go to each member of the team and swap their stones with just regular pedestrian rocks. And once he has all of those stones, he finally is able to get to the place that he hasn't been able to reach, right? That universe underneath our own, where these Infinity Stones don't even work. Their stones are just stones. But he keeps them anyway, just in case. But he is a god. He doesn't believe that he'll need any more magic than what he has within him. And as he approaches the beings of that universe and realizes that they very well may be the puppet masters of our universe, he looks upon many, many Celestials. Meanwhile, his team is returned to the Soul Gem universe, and they're being, including the adult Gamora, and she's being attacked by the warped versions of the heroes. So we'll see what comes of that. And then the last few pages, we see Arthur and Yvette, and I don't know who these two are supposed to be at all. But they are driving along a road, and they then have an accident. Arthur pulls out a saxophone, leans against a tree, and the tree then comes to life and says, "We are Pete." So obviously some sort of version of Groot mashed up with who, I'm not sure. But he grabs Art and flies off, and we get a to be continued. So something to do with the Fallen Guardian book, I suppose. But what I do know is there's only one issue of Infinity Wars left. So I may get a lot more out of it if I was reading the rest of the tie-ins, but I'm not. I'm just reading the main series. And it is interesting enough. The art by Mike Diodato is the best art of his career. It's incredible for color work by Frank Martin, and everybody's acting as you would expect them to, especially Loki, with maybe the exception of Gamora having acted so out of character to try to free the other part of herself from Gemworld. So again, this might be a series where you're going to get a lot more out of it if you read the countdown to Infinity Wars and then you're reading all the tie-ins. But part of the reason I wanted to read it was I wanted to see if I needed to have read all that stuff and I needed to be caught up on the cosmic corner of the Marvel Universe. And I find that you don't. I'm finding that this is interesting enough on its own. But I do think a second reread after all six issues are out is going to benefit me greatly to kind of understand exactly what's going on, because it is a bit fast-paced. And I talked about this on today's other episode that I already mentioned, the Aftershock episode with the Black Eyed Kids and how fast-paced that story is, but it doesn't feel like any parts are missing. This one, with the style of art being somewhat limiting in the number of panels you can have on the page, and by that I mean it's very detailed and very impactful, so you need somewhat bigger panels, which then limits the number of panels that you can put on a page, it does feel like at certain points there's a little bit of narration or a little bit of exposition that's not there that would really help tell the story better. But again, if you're reading the entire event, you may be picking up the other information you need in those other titles. Or maybe if you've just been following along in the cosmic corner of the Marvel Universe all this time and you're not behind the way I am, you may be getting more out of it as well. But that's not to say that any of that is needed, because I am really enjoying the story as is. And I can't wait to see where it wraps up in just one more issue, especially with Loki. I do get the feeling that they're almost trying to turn Loki into an anti-hero, probably because of his popularity in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because I've never really known Loki to have any redeeming qualities at all. But here he was kind of on the side of angels, if only for a little while. I was almost overjoyed to see him kind of trick everybody and flip the script and be like, you know, you thought that I was just trying to stop Gamora, but really all along I wanted the gems for myself. Like, that's the Loki I know. But based on the popularity of the Tom Hiddleston character, you wonder if they're not trying to make him into a character so they can market him that way and take advantage of that popularity. So just a thought. All right, next issue I'm going to talk about is Death of the Inhumans, number 5. This is the final issue of the series, and it's from writer Donny Cates, with art by Ariel Olivetti, color work by Jordi Belair, and letters by Clayton Cowles. This has been a really, really fun series, a series that makes me want to go back and get caught up on all the Inhuman stuff that Marvel was attempting to shove down our throats a few years ago, and for the most part, I skipped. I will say kind of one negative about this issue is that, based on the impact and the narrative that Cates was building to, the climax almost feels like a little bit of a letdown. And it's not because it doesn't make sense or it's something that was unexpected, because again, it's something that has been hinted at all along and totally building toward. But it just felt, I don't want to say easy, but it just didn't, I feel like it just didn't land like emotionally and impactfully the way that I expected it to. I kind of expected, I don't really think it's art wise. I don't know. It was missing something emotionally for me. But maybe like a lot of these series, when you go back and read it as a whole, it'll end up reading a little bit better. So the issue starts off with Black Bolt thinking about the prophecy of the fact that this Midnight King is going to come and destroy the Kree Empire at some point. And then he meets up with Karnak, who gives him an assessment. And in that assessment, we kind of get an understanding of what's happened inside the series so far up to this point, how these Vox monsters have really been Inhumans that have been kidnapped and teleported, with the Vox taking advantage of the captured Lockjaw. And all along, all these Inhumans we thought were being disintegrated were really being teleported and placed inside Vox armor to then be used as an army for the Inhumans. We also learn about the damage that's been done to Black Bolt's vocal cords, and we do realize that not only has his voice been taken from him, you know, he's able to speak somewhat in a whisper without it being destructive, and he's able to use his voice like a scalpel and kill up close, you know, one person at a time. He has one big scream left in him, and Karnak knows that. And we also know that if Black Bolt chooses to pull that pin, that's it for his voice. He'll never speak again. So Karnak says, you know, I'm not one to tell you to stay silent. Not now. We've already lost this fight. So when you do scream, just make sure that it counts. So Black Bolt then joins the rest of his team, his wife Medusa, Gorgon, Beta Ray Bill, and he signs to them that he apologizes. He's been arrogant, and he feels responsible for allowing the enemy to do what they've done to them, right? There's never in his life been an enemy that he feels like he couldn't shout down in a way that's made him weak. It's made him overconfident. And it's partly responsible for why the Inhumans are in the state that they're in. So whatever happens now, they die together as a family. And he asks for a moment of silence for the team before they go to rescue those Inhumans that have been turned into Vox monsters. Meanwhile, in that very factory, they're talking about the fact that they don't believe that Black Bolt has the technical and tactical abilities to be a danger to them. And they actually allowed Black Bolt to escape and gather his family, because why waste energy hunting them when they'll gladly return to us? And return they do. They do attack the facility, but then Black Bolt enters the facility alone and traps the rest of his team outside the facility to battle one of the Vox soldiers, as well as Lockjaw, who apparently has been brainwashed with the same kind of technology. And the Vox soldier that is there to fight them is actually Crystal. So once Black Bolt enters the facility, he's able to fight his way to the center of the facility, and he does scream one last time with all of his might. And he closes his eyes as he breaks his throat one final time, because he allows himself to know the truth of the prophecy, to truly bring the ruin to the Kree Empire that the Midnight King was prophesied to bring. He knows that he must kill the Inhumans as well. So he unleashes his power, his vocal power, one last time, not only killing what Inhumans are standing ahead of him, in front of him, as Vox monsters, as Vox soldiers, but it also destroys the machinery of the Vox, which then allows Crystal and Lockjaw to return to normal. And they're horrified at what they've done, and they don't remember much. But Beta Ray Bill has a heartwarming reunion with Lockjaw, and Crystal asks if the war is really over, and Medusa says it is as much as it can be. And Black Bolt then emerges from the facility with blood dripping down his chin, and they know that his voice is no more. And then we get some great exposition about Rome not being built in a day, but it did burn in one, as Medusa asks Lockjaw to teleport them back home. So upon the ashes of that great empire, Rome was rebuilt and Rome rose again. So I imagine that we haven't seen the last of the Inhumans, because to this day and for all the days still to come, Rome remains, and these Inhumans remain as well. So the other thing that was really obvious to me, which, you know, we talked about right from the beginning when we started covering Death of Inhumans, was this is really a way to clean up the huge propagation of Inhumans that Marvel allowed to happen when they were trying to use them as a replacement for the X-Men. So Cates has really kind of cleaned house with the number of Inhumans. So many of them have been slaughtered, but so many of the important ones remain, right? Lockjaw, who we speculated, they can't kill Lockjaw, right? Lockjaw has returned. Maximus is gone for good. Crystal remains. But I feel like perhaps the most important part of this story, other than it just being super enjoyable and showing again, once again, the incredible talent of Donny Cates, is the consequence that Black Bolt has lost his voice. You can't imagine that that's going to last for forever, but it does give a new status quo for Black Bolt that would allow for some interesting stories. Can he remain king if he doesn't have that power, right? Is he worthy of leading the Inhumans? And what price might he be expected to pay for not properly protecting the Inhuman race, as it were? So again, really fun story. Another one that I feel like I need to reread all five issues in one sitting to give more perspective on it. Because again, I just felt like that moment when Black Bolt screams for the final time. I don't know. I almost feel like I wish this last issue of the series had been double-sized, because it feels like Donnie Cates just didn't have enough time to really build to it. You know, it's like they arrive on the planet, Black Bolt traps the other people outside. He runs into the heart of the station himself. He screams, story's over, war is over. Just kind of happened a little bit fast for me. I wish there had been a little more time to enjoy it or to build to it. So anyway, the next issue I'm going to talk about is the Marvel Knights MK 20th anniversary miniseries. I'm not sure how many issues this is, but it's really, I wasn't sure that I was going to read it, actually, to be honest with you. But then I thought about the importance of Marvel Knights and how, like, so much of the MCU and the Marvel Netflix universe is based on Marvel Knights and the stories that were created there. So I was like, man, this is really important. I probably should take the time to at least check out the first issue and then, based on the strength of that, see if I'm going to continue. So I have to say, based on the strength of this issue, because I didn't have any idea what the story was about, but based on the strength of this, I'm totally in. Like, I think that Quesada and Palmiotti should be very pleased with the legacy and the way that legacy of Marvel Knights is being honored by the story that Donny Cates and Travel Foreman are telling, because this is a great idea for a story, super interesting, and I can't wait to see where it goes from here. Creative team, as I mentioned, writer Donny Cates, penciler Travel Foreman. We also have inks by Derek Fridolfs, colors by Matt Milla, and the letters are by Corey Petit. So the issue starts off, or the series starts off, with Matt Murdock in a graveyard. He's in front of Karen Page's grave. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know why he's there. He doesn't know that even though he's blind, he can somehow sort of see, especially because it's raining. And why does the raised letters of this tombstone that say Karen Page hurt his fingers so much? And why, this is perhaps most important, why does it feel so good to hurt like this? So as he's there, a figure approaches, calls him Daredevil, says, "Don't be afraid, I'm not here to hurt you." He has, even though he's wearing a patrolman's uniform, his badge says Detective Castle, or his name, on his jacket there. And, he's like, "I need to speak with you and tell you a few things." And, the man, Daredevil's like, "What, did you say Daredevil?" And he says, "Yeah, my name's Frank Castle, and I'm trying to explain to you, something big has happened. All of us have fallen down and forgotten, and I need your help putting it back together." But Daredevil doesn't believe him necessarily. He's like, "I don't know who you are. How can I know, you know, I don't know who I am. How can I believe you?" And Castle's like, "Okay, so let me tell you what I know about you, because, you know, the guy that's giving me this information told me to write it down. He says you go by Daredevil, blinded as a kid, got some radioactive crap in your eyes. Now you have extra senses, you wear a costume, fight crime in Hell's Kitchen. And I guess you're Catholic. So, you know, if your guy upstairs is listening, might be a good time to call in a favor." And Matt Murdock doesn't want to believe. He's like, "This is insane. I don't remember any of this." And Castle says, "Yeah, you do. There's part of you that does, right? They might be able to take a lot of stuff away from us, but they can't take away your crazy senses. So listen to my heartbeat and you'll know I'm telling the truth." And Matt then turns to Castle and says, "Who is she? Like, why this tombstone? Karen Page, do you know her?" Castle says, "I don't, but I guess, you know, we could find out. Banner said we should look for you here, and I can ask him about the girl if you want." And Matt says, "Banner?" He says, "Yeah, the guy who knows everything, or rather the guy who knows the guy who knows everything, because he's got some crazy kind of source that only comes to him when he sleeps, and he writes the notes, and they look like they're written by a little kid." So it's the Hulk, right? It's the Hulk who remembers. The Hulk's brain is not affected by whatever it is that's affecting the rest of the heroes. So Matt rejects all this. He's like, "No, this can't be right." Castle's like, "Dude, I've been chasing guys like you all day. I'm tired of getting nowhere. Please don't run. I know what it looks like when a guy's about to run, and I really need you not to run." But of course, Daredevil runs. And so Castle chases after him, hits him in the head after he grabs his jacket trying to stop him. But that smack in the head as Castle grabs him and accidentally rips open his shirt, the combination of that hit on the head and seeing the costume he wears sparks some memory in him of who he is. He says he remembers everything, but he remembers everything about himself, not necessarily everything about everybody, because then he would realize who Frank Castle is. And Castle says, yeah, that's good. Sorry I had to hit you like that, but old habits die hard. And Murdoch decides not to join up with Frank Castle, knocks him down, says, yeah, old habits. And Punisher, or Frank Castle rather, is real surprised, like, what are you doing, man? I'm trying to help you. Murdoch's like, I don't trust you. I don't trust you. I don't need your help. Don't follow me. And he runs off. And Castle thinks, well, hell, and heads back to his cruiser. And Banner asks, so how'd it go? And Castle's response is about as well as the last lunatic with the claws, but he did wake up. He just, he still doesn't know who I was. How does that work? And Banner says, well, you woke him up and you woke up and didn't remember him. I had to tell you, right? And Castle says, all right, damn it. I hate all this crap. Who's next? And Banner has a list, and next up on the list is Electro Nachios. And we do see the following names on the list: Tony Stark, Jessica Jones, and Luke Cage. So meanwhile, somebody has been observing all this, and he calls in to his boss, says, yes, sir, cop just left with a little twitchy nerd. And the other guy who wanted me to follow Murdoch, he's awake, he knows. And do you want me to kill him? Because I think I used to do that. But apparently he's supposed to just hang back and listen. And as he pulls the beanie off his head, we see the bullseye-shaped scar on his forehead. And, of course, it's Bullseye. So meanwhile, Daredevil does have a lot of his memories back. So he heads to the law office of Foggy Nelson, climbs in through a window. Foggy's scared to death, doesn't have any idea who Matt is, doesn't have any idea who this crazy person that climbed in through his window is. The door to his office opens. We see a woman there on the phone saying, I've already called the police. And who is she? Well, it's Jennifer Walters. So Matt is unable to convince either of them of who he is. And in fact, when he tries to pull out his ID, Jennifer grabs his hand. And we do notice that her hand does turn a little green as she grabs it. And although he has an ID that has his name and says New York State Bar Association, when Foggy looks at it, he says it's blank. There's nothing written there. And Matt's like, that's not true. That's not true. But the police show up. And so he beats a hasty retreat, and he runs down the street, escaping from the cops. He runs into somebody as he's trying to figure out where to go, what to do next. And when he looks up, he realizes the person that he's run into is the Thing. And he obviously doesn't know who the Thing is, but he sees the Thing as this monster, right? He sees Johnny Storm as this flaming being. He sees Reed Richards as this elongated necked man. He sees the Fantastic Four for who they really are, even though when they see themselves, they see only normal humans. Like Ben Grimm looks at his reflection in the window and sees Ben Grimm looking back at him, not the Thing. So Matt doesn't know what to do. He's lost. He goes up on a rooftop and sits on a water tower and actually prays, because he doesn't know what to do. For the first time in his life since he was a child, he knows who he is, but he doesn't know what to do. And he prays, and the person that comes to him and holding out a hand and telling him to stand up is Karen Page. So not exactly sure how that whole thing works. But we do see that Bullseye then has reported into his boss. And in exchange for his services so far, he gets his file that says Bullseye. And he gets to read it and find out who he is. And he then asks, what's the deal with this Murdoch guy? And his boss says, if I'm being honest, I have no idea who Matt Murdoch is. And we do find out his boss is the Kingpin. So even the Kingpin himself doesn't remember who Matt Murdoch is, or why they're after him, or like how much does the Kingpin even know, right? Because Bullseye says, well, if you don't know what the deal with Murdoch is, if you don't know that he's Daredevil, then why, like, what's going on? Like, why am I running all over town following him? And Kingpin just responds with Lester. And Bullseye says, yeah, right. If you'll let me know if I need to know anything. And as the Kingpin opens up a secret room with all these pictures of various secret identities on them and wondering if they're right, saying, who are you? We see a voice off panel say, so the devil is awake, interesting. And we actually see the Kingpin get down on his hands and knees saying, my lord, I did not know you would be here. He's bowing to somebody. And the voice says, I come as I please. You are uneasy. Tell me why. And the Kingpin says, I don't mean to doubt, but you know, why don't we just make them forget again? Why not use the machine to... So clearly there's some machine that this guy has found or invented that has caused this. And the fact that it's somebody that the Kingpin is scared of says a lot, right? The shrouded figure says, there's a dragon wrapped around the machine. Wilson, even one I cannot best, but I will. And this I promise, when I do, they will know only doom. And we get the last page of the issue. We see Dr. Doom standing there, flanked by Taskmaster and Crossbones. And we get the to be continued. So first of all, the Kingpin bowing down before anybody is a really great visual. And the fact that it's Doom and he's at his most malevolent here is really awesome. And I love Crossbones, and I love, love, love Taskmaster as villains. So it's great that they appear to be Doom's lieutenants in this. And I can only imagine where the story's going to go from here, because if there's anybody that plans out really intricate, evil plots to like take over the world and to change things, it's Dr. Doom, right? Like, this totally is a Doom thing to do, to make all the heroes forget who they are. So can't wait for more of this MK20 series. And as I said at the beginning when I started talking about it, it's a fitting legacy to the Marvel Knights imprint that Quesada and Palmiotti started so long ago. As far as the art goes, it's pretty solid. I'm used to Travel Foreman's art being a lot less polished than this. I don't know if he's trying a different style or if it's just the addition of Derek Fridolfs as his inker, but the art is pretty solid in this, especially give a shout out to the way he depicts Daredevil and just how bewildered and alone and desperate he seems at various times. Also, the color work is handled really, really well. Also, it's somewhat of a muted palette, except where it needs to be, like the page where Matt remembers that he's Daredevil. We get a lot of scenes of classic Daredevil. We even see some of the yellow and red costume. And in those pages, the art really, or the colors rather, really jump off the page. So I have to specifically call out the job that Matt Miller did on colors, because, you know, normally we, or at least I have only ever seen him do the Charles Soule Daredevil book, which is a much different kind of art style. It's almost diachromatic in a way, just, you know, a couple of colors. So seeing him do something where his color palette is a lot more varied is really great to see, that he can handle that just as deftly as the color work that he did on Daredevil. So a really, really great issue. I'm really impressed with issue one, and I'm definitely going to have to be picking up another Marvel title because it's really, really good. Well, speaking of Charles Soule's Daredevil, that's the last issue I'm going to talk about for this Marvel Monday. We're on issue number 8. It's an all-new story, Blind Man's Bluff. It's from writer Charles Soule. We've got art by Goran Suzuka and colors by the aforementioned Matt Miller. And in this story, Matt Murdock has gone to Macau, and he's actually playing poker. He's playing Texas Hold'em. And the reason he's doing this, we're not exactly sure. There's a flashback in the issue that shows that he was looking for something that the Black Cat had stolen, and the trail has led him to a casino in Macau where he's entered this Texas Hold'em tournament. And the reason he has is because the casino there is actually employing a telepath named Apex, who uses his abilities or had used his abilities to hustle casinos in the past all over the world. And eventually it caught up to him because a lot of those casinos have their own telepaths. And once Apex was caught by the people that run this casino in Macau, he was forced to work for the casino, right? Otherwise, it was that or a short helicopter ride and a long drop into the South China Sea. So basically, he enters the tournaments. He sees the cards through the other player's own eyes through the use of his telepathy, and he's able to win the tournaments. So what's great is Daredevil, Matt Murdock, he doesn't have that ability, right? He doesn't have the ability to see the cards. He's playing Texas Hold'em because more so than any other game, it's a card game where or a poker game where you're playing the other person, right? More so than you're playing the cards on the table. So with his ability to hear people's heartbeats and know when they're bluffing or when they're worried that their hand is not any good or any kind of other tell they might have that's not readily apparent to anybody with normal senses, but is so readily apparent to Matt with his super senses. It's a great tool. It's a great narrative trick for Charles Soule to have come up with to use to tell this story, because Apex can't read the cards because Matt himself doesn't know what cards he has, right? He has no idea. He's merely playing the other players rather than playing the cards. What their reactions are to the cards are a way for Matt to know what his own reactions are. So there's a kind of a sub-narrative, if you will, when the final confrontation takes place in this issue of Apex and Matt kind of facing off. They're not only are they facing off on the poker table, but they're also facing off on kind of a mental plane, right? And Matt pictures that as them fighting on a mountaintop in Tibet. And Matt himself thinks about how he's got psychic defenses. Stick and his other senseis taught him to protect his mind as well as his body. And with so many telepaths in the world, his secret identity is only as strong as his mental walls are. And so this fight is not really anything new to him. And he's remarking to himself just how strong Apex is. And he's commenting on the fact that this is his mind's interpretation of the attack that Apex is giving him, and he manages to switch it. He switches it when he raises and they go from a mountaintop in Tibet to the boxing ring, right? Battling Jack Murdock, a throwback to his father. So as he thinks about the stakes that are being raised, he realizes that it's not just a game anymore, because if Apex has managed to break through his defenses, he'll know everything. He'll know not only the way Matt Murdock or Daredevil is trying to win, but he'll know who he is. He'll know he's Matt Murdock. He'll know everything about him. So ultimately, Daredevil, because of his mental abilities, more so than anything else, his mental resolve, he's able to beat Apex in the long run. But once he does beat Apex, Apex passes out and Matt gets the check, but knows that it kind of sucks because he'll never be able to cash it. They've offered him the best hotel room in the house because they want to figure out how he beat Apex. And of course, they want to try to keep him long enough there for him to gamble the money away as well. But despite the fact that he has a woman admirer who wants to spend some time with him, who we spoke to earlier in the issue, Matt says, I got a friend to meet and I'll see you later. But once again, Matt laments that he won't be able to cash the check, $10 million. And it's not a bad day's work, but it's made out to the alias that Matt's using, Laurent Lavoisier, and it'll have to just go to waste, despite the fact that Matt's 10 grand down because of the buy-in plus the plane ticket and all that. But he changes into his Daredevil costume, thinks about how it's just the cost of doing business and that it's time to get to work. And once he gets to the roof of the hotel, we see the person that he talked about, he planned on meeting, who says, well, it took you long enough. And we see it's Spider-Man hanging upside down from a jutting out of the hotel roof. And what's curious here is his spider appears to be glowing blue a little bit, as well as his eyes. So not sure if that's just some choices by the colorist, Matt Miller, or if there's something else going on with Spider-Man. So we'll get a team up in Macau next Marvel Monday of Daredevil and Spider-Man, which is really a classic team up. Those guys have been friends for a long time. The series have been around for a long time, and there's nothing quite as cool as a great Spidey Daredevil team up. So really, really fun issue. Great to see Matt playing cards and reading the other players, whether it's detecting somebody tapping their toes inside their shoes as a tell, or knowing what their heartbeats being calm or raised, elevated heart rate, what all those things mean. Not so different from having actual skills to read people's reaction to things like real poker players, real professional poker players have. It's an acquired skill. Like you sit there at the table for a little while and you need to kind of observe and, you know, see how does somebody react when they win a hand? How do they react when they lose a hand? Anything you can pick up. It's all information. And, it's even though that he couldn't see the cards, the advantage that Matt has with, being able to always see the reaction to people's particular hands based on winning or losing. I mean, it's invaluable information. And again, much like with the looking into a mirror comment that Captain America talked about, Steve Rogers talked about with Daredevil at some point. And, you know, I asked Charles Soule about that at New York Comic Con, and he was talking about different ways to explore what are things that a blind man or Daredevil specifically, what are things that he faces that regular people don't, and how can Charles explore that for the first time? It's a lot of fun. So if you haven't read any of Charles Soule's Daredevil run, man, I really encourage you to go and start it from the very beginning, because it's really, really high quality Daredevil storytelling, in my opinion. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.